Charlene Huttergault, NPR News, Pretoria.
According to an annual survey of the airline industry, airlines carried fewer people in 2008, but did a better job for those who did fly. Private researchers say that the rates of lost bags, late arrivals, passengers bumped from overbooked flights, and consumer complaints all declined. The average on-time performance was a little better, yet nearly one quarter of all flights were late. That on-time rate was 80% or better for only three airlines, Hawaiian Airlines, Southwest, and U.S. Airways. High fuel costs and a poor economy have led many airlines to reduce schedules, raise ticket prices, and charge fees for everything from luggage to pillows. The research is based on government statistics sponsored by the Aviation Institute at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Here's the question that we'll try to take up in the first hour of the program today. Are we alone in the universe? Or might there be other places, either in our immediate neighborhood or perhaps beyond, that can support life? We'll be talking about this these questions this morning with astronomer Alan Boss. He's the author of a recently published book that's titled The Crowded Universe. The subtitle is The Search for Living Planets, and it's published by Basic Books. He makes the argument that in the coming years that we will indeed find abundant Earth-like planets, so hence the title, The Crowded Universe, including many planets that are indisputably alive. Not only, he says, is life possible elsewhere in the universe, he believes that it is common. A little bit more about our guest, Alan Boss, is one of the world's leading authorities on the formation of stars and planets. He's a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in with questions is that you try to keep your questions or comments brief. And the reason we ask that is just so we can keep moving and get as many callers in as possible. But, of course, callers are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. And we do also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Dr. Boss, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
We
appreciate it.
Just as a way of starting out, and we can talk about how these were discovered, but in fact, in the last, I think, maybe about the last decade or so, there has been an explosion in the numbers of planets that have been observed to be orbiting stars. So I suppose one of the first things you say, if you're looking for life out there, you're looking for Earth-like planets, you start by asking, well, are there other places where there are planets of whatever sort orbiting stars? And the answer to that question is yes, that there's a whole bunch of them. How many at this point have been identified?
Well, the number changes on almost a daily basis, but the head count right now is somewhere around 340 to 350 planets that we know about around other stars, which is tremendous because, as you say, just a little over 10 years ago, we knew of no other planets besides our own planetary system. So it's a tremendous change in our point of view on what we know out there.
And as we go along and continue to make observations and perhaps also improve the tools that we have for making the observations, that there is, it sounds as if there's every reason to believe that that number would continue to increase.
Oh, no, that's exactly right, because more and more folks are getting interested in this. More and more astronomers are using their telescopes. And in fact, we're now on the verge of beginning to put up space telescopes, which can actually do a much better job than some of the ground-based surveys are doing. In fact, NASA just launched the Kepler Space Telescope early in March. And Kepler is the one that actually will go out and count how many Earths are in the universe. Mm.
And some, as you note, and again, I'm sure we could talk more about this, but just to mention it right up front, not only have some of these things, discoveries been made, observations been made using Earth-based telescopes. In fact, apparently some of these things have actually been observed by amateur astronomers, so it's not just professional astronomers using the biggest, most sophisticated instruments.
Exactly right. In fact, the very first transiting planet, that is a planet whose orbit turned out to be aligned such that the planet would pass in front of the star and temporarily cause the star to dim a little bit. That first detection of a transiting planet was found by a couple of professional astronomers, but they were using a rather modest telescope, a 4-inch diameter telescope, and they took the observations while observing in the parking lot of one of their office buildings in Boulder, Colorado. So it was a modest telescope and taken from a, what you might say, a non-ideal site, but they could still measure that dimming of the star because the planet they were looking at was a quite large planet. It was able to dim the starlight by about 1%, and a good amateur telescope person can measure that.
Now, given the fact that, as you say, some of these things have been seen using not the most sophisticated instruments, and we certainly should have had been able to make these observations before, why is it, was there something in particular that had happened around 10 years or so ago, right at the point where we suddenly had this big jump in the number of planets observed to be orbiting stars elsewhere in the universe?
It was basically a refinement of the techniques for looking for planets by the indirect method. Essentially, all of these discoveries have been made so far. We don't actually see the planet directly. What we do is infer the presence of the planet by its effect on the star it orbits around. And so these techniques are called indirect detection techniques, and they rely on the fact that the star and the planet both orbit around the center of mass of the system. Center of mass is just the balance point, like on a teeter-totter, where you would balance everything out. And in the case of the sun orbits around a center of mass, which is about one solar diameter away from its center, and it orbits around with a velocity of about 30 miles per hour due to the fact that it has Jupiter orbiting around the center of mass as well. Mm. So the big advance was for astronomers to develop spectrometers that could measure velocity changes of stars on the order of 30 miles per hour. And several different groups were doing that, including a Canadian group from the early 1980s, and several American groups in the mid-1980s were doing this. But the folks who struck pay dirt first were a Swiss group, Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz, in 1995. They found the very first Jupiter mass planet around a sun-like star, and they did it in part because they were the first, because they were willing to look for all sorts of strange short-period oscillations in their data. Most of the astronomers, American astronomers who were looking for a 12-year periodicity, which is Jupiter's orbital period. But the Swiss were able to come into this with a different point of view and look for even very short periodicities. And so they found the first Jupiter because it had this surprisingly, incredibly short orbital period of not 12 years, but 4 days. Mm. And that was the discovery that sent the field on fire. Once the Swiss found that and announced it and other folks went on and confirmed it, other people started searching their data and realized, hey, we may actually already have some planets we've detected. We just didn't realize they could have such short periods. So it's a combination of technology plus, say, a freeing of the mind, as it were, as to what sorts of planets might be out there. And the Swiss led the way on that.
And I think that what happened was that once that kind of thing had been seen, then astronomers went back and looked at data they had already accumulated, perhaps looking at it in a slightly different way. And suddenly they realized that it was there in front of them all the time. It's just that they hadn't really looked for it.
Exactly right. So when the Swiss announced this in a conference in Italy in October of 95, and other astronomers went to their telescopes literally the next week, and just with 4 nights of telescope time, you could prove that 4-day period was true. In fact, my colleagues, Jeff Marcy from UC Berkeley and Paul Butler at the Carnegie Institution, they had been taking data since 1987. They went back and started crunching through their data. In part, they didn't have computers, and so they had to get some computers donated to them by Sun Microsystems. They sat and crunched through their data and realized by January, just a couple months later, that they actually had two more planets to announce. And so they, in January 1996, they announced those, and suddenly we went from 0 to 1 with the Swiss to 3 with the Swiss plus Marcy and Butler. So it was a tremendous beginning of the field, just went from 0 to high speed right away.
Yeah. Just very quickly here, for anybody who might have tuned in the last few minutes, I'd like to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Alan Boss. He is a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, and knows a lot about the formation of stars and planets, and is the author of the recently published book, The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. It's published by Basic Books, and it takes a look at some of the scientific work that has been done, aimed at trying to answer the question, well, are there other planets orbiting other stars, and what can we know about them? How many of them are there? And is the possibility there that we could find something that was kind of like Earth in the right position with the right makeup where there might be life? Questions again, a welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you talked about one of the ways that scientists have answered this question, look for planets that orbit stars, and you can do that by looking at the movement of the star that the planet is orbiting, because the planet will have an effect on the movement of that star. It may be small, you might have to look pretty close, but you can see it. It is possible, apparently, also, though, to, again, and this maybe is a matter of luck, because you have to be looking at the right time to see the planet that is orbiting the star. Actually, you can see it move across the face of the star. But again, is it that it's just that, you know, depending on how long the orbit of the planet is and so forth, that may almost be a matter of luck that you just happen to see it when it is passing in front of the star?
That's exactly right. That's the second way of finding planets. It's been quite successful. The so-called transit method, where the passage of the planet in front of the star is called a transit. And for the planets, like the very first one that was found by the Swiss, it's orbiting on this very short period orbit, 4 days, and so it's very close to its star, and the star is, of course, making the planet quite hot, so it's called a hot Jupiter. And when these hot Jupiters are that close to the star, that means you actually have a very good chance of having their orbits inclined such that one of them will be passing in front of its star. It's roughly a 10% chance when you're that close in, because you're actually quite close to the surface of the star, and there's a good chance that your orbit will be inclined such that you pass over the surface of the star. So by the time we had found 10 hot Jupiters, we were wondering, gee, one of them should be transiting. And it took actually the discovery of the 10th hot Jupiter before that very first one was found to transit by David Charbonneau and Tim Brown in that parking lot in Boulder, Colorado. So nature had a little bit of fun with us. She waited until we gave us the 10th one, and finally we saw it to transit. Now, the really exciting part about transits is, of course, they will also work for planets even farther out. But as you say, the chances are a little bit lower. So, in fact, for looking for Earth-like planets, which are roughly 10 times farther away from their stars, the chances are not 1 in 10, but they're 1 in 100. And so if you're going to try to find Earth, which is what the Kepler spacecraft is doing, you've got to look at a lot of stars, and eventually you will find a few that will transit. If you're looking at enough of them at a 1% level, they should pass in front of their star and give you a measurable dimming of the star. And that's how Kepler's going to find Earth.
And this is we can talk more about this. This was launched not too long ago. It is a space-based telescope, and the idea is that you're focusing just on one spot, and it will continue to take observations for a period, focusing on that one spot for a period of years. So the hope would be that over that time, if you concentrate on the same spot, that you're going to see some of these things.
Exactly. Kepler was launched just exactly 1 month ago, on March 6th. It'll be staring at a field of stars with initially about 170,000 stars. It'll be following in the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra. It will stare continuously for at least 3.5 years, because you have to look for that long if you want to find Earth-like planets. By definition, an Earth-like planet, at least around a Sun-like star, has an orbital period of roughly one Earth year. And so if you see just one dimming, that tells you, all right, something may be there. You have to wait 1 year later to see a second dimming, and then you have a time period between the two. You have a prediction that, all right, we just saw, took 1 year for these two dimmings to occur. Let's wait 1 year later to see a third dimming. All right, you see that one 2 years later, you're all set. Maybe it's real, but let's wait for that fourth dimming 3 years after the very first dimming. Mm-hmm. So by the time you see four of them, you start saying, this may be real, we should publish a paper about it. But it's taking you at least 3 years to do that. So it's a very arduous, painstaking type of measurement to make. You have to wait a long time to see a very, very tiny effect that just lasts for a few hours. But that's what Kepler is going to be doing, and that's the one way we know right now that we can actually go out and find Earth mass planets on Earth-like orbits, worlds that could very well be habitable.
And the mission, I think, for Kepler is for 3 years, and I guess that after that, the decision could be made to extend it. Is 3 years really long enough?
It is barely enough. It's actually formally 3.5 years for what it's worth, just to give you a little bit of slop. You know, given, as we just sort of said, you need at least 3 years. And so given some phasing problems, 3.5 years should get you a lot of Earth. But I think the feeling is, yes, that if Kepler does indeed, in those first 3.5 years, find abundant evidence for Earth, which I argue is what's going to happen, then hopefully NASA headquarters will have a process called a senior review where they get together with some distinguished members of the science community, and they look at what Kepler's produced, and they come look at how much money they've got in the bank, and they decide maybe we can extend this mission for a few more years. So hopefully Kepler, I think, may last for as long as, I think, about 6 years. I think they have enough fuel on board to keep Kepler going for that time period. Mm-hmm. And if Kepler can actually run for 6 years, they will do a fantastic job of finding Earth, even out to basically Mars-like distances. It's a little bit farther out than the Earth's orbit, but so it'll pretty much cover the habitable zone, that is the orbital periods and orbital distances on which a planet like the Earth can have liquid water. And so we'll know an awful lot at that point about exactly how many potentially habitable worlds there are.
Mm-hmm. We have some callers here. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, where we are. This is line one.
Yes.
Yes, hello. Yes.
Hi. Very interesting topic. Hey, one of the most maddening conundrums, at least to myself, would be assuming, you know, there's a given number of Earth-like planets out there. I guess I was wondering if you could comment, speculate on just the sheer distance of everything and how to overcome that technologically. So thanks a lot. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, the ones that Kepler is going to find are all going to be towards the constellation Cygnus and Lyra, so they're typically not going to be terribly close to us. They'll be typically maybe 1,500 to 2,000 light years away. So, but we think that those planets that they're going to be taken in that census will be indicative of what the planets are like much closer to our own sun. So Kepler will give us a frequency. It'll say, hey, if you look at sun-like stars, you know, 79% of them have Earths, or maybe it's 78%, or maybe it's 56%. It's going to be some rather high number, I would predict, quite close to one. But as we just said, those are going to be pretty far away. They're not exactly close by planets. They're sort of on the other side of the county, as it were, from where we're living. So we want to really find out where the planets are on our block or the neighborhood. We want to walk down our street and see where the nearby planets are. They're within maybe, you know, 5, 10, 20 light years away. And Kepler won't be able to do that because it's all going to be staring towards us, the constellation Cygnus and Lyra. So the next step might be to build a spacecraft called the Space Interferometry Mission, which the NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been planning for some time. SIM actually is quite capable of going out and finding all the Earth mass planets around the very closest stars. And SIM will do that not by looking for transits, but by actually looking for that wobble again that we talked about. This time, though, the wobble will not be measured by spectroscopy by looking for a Doppler shift of the velocities of this plus or minus 30 miles per hour. But instead, SIM will be looking for the wobble, the actual positional wobble of the star on the sky, the fact that that sun-like star will be wobbling around a circle around the center of mass roughly equal to its own diameter. And if it's equal to, if it has a Jupiter mass planet around it, if it has an Earth-like planet, the circle will be wobbling around is about 1,000 times smaller, which is a pretty tiny wobble, but it's one that the Space Interferometry Mission has been designed to be able to detect. So if we find out from Kepler that Earths are quite common, which I think is going to be the case, perhaps the next step then will be for NASA to give the green light to the SIM mission. And SIM is basically ready to go. JPL has done all the technology development for it. They've done a lot of work on it for the last 10 years or so. And if you give them the green light, they can put SIM together in a couple of years and get it up there and actually go down, basically walk down our street of the neighborhood and find out where the houses are that are potentially habitable.
Well, of course, there are people, there are scientists who argue that there might be some good places here to look within our own solar system. So at least there would be technological challenges, but the distance issue isn't quite as great. But having said that, if we're going to say we're going to look outside of our own solar system, it's an awful long way to the next star. Is it reasonable, I mean, just in scientific and technological terms, to think about not going there, not people going there, but some sort of probe going there in some sort of timely fashion, in a way also that you could transmit back any information about what you found? I mean, would you be able to do that within a lifetime?
We would love to be able to do that, but unfortunately, to do it within one of our lifetimes, very quickly this whole proposition becomes one of science fiction rather than science fact. Mm-hmm. The best way to really study nearby Earths would be to use basically remote sensing to build a space telescope that can take a picture of that nearby Earth, because that light is already on its way to us. We don't have to wait for that light. It's actually coming here. We just have to be able to intercept the light and understand it. So if we wanted to build a spacecraft and send it there, that would be pretty tough, because unless we come up with some brand new, as I say, almost science fiction type concepts, if we use our existing technology, the basic chemical propulsion systems that we use to fire our robots around the solar system, I think the fastest moving spacecraft we have now, which is the New Horizons spacecraft, which is on its way to Pluto, so it's trying to cover the greatest distance towards its target that any NASA robotic mission has had to cover. It's really got a long way to go out to Pluto's orbit. At the rate at which that New Horizons mission is moving, it would basically take 100,000 years to get to the very closest star system, to the Alpha Centauri system. So that's 100,000 years. We don't really want to wait 100,000 years for that spacecraft to take a picture and send us back an email with a JPEG image attached. Yeah. You know, that's 100,000 years. We will probably have evolved into some other species by then. I mean, 100,000 years ago, we were probably more like Neanderthals than humans at that point. So that's a little bit disappointing. That's why I think the next steps will be, once we realize that there are a lot of Earths in the universe, we're going to want to build an even larger space telescope, something even bigger than SIM, something like the terrestrial planet finders that NASA has been also developing. Those telescopes will be able to take a picture of a nearby Earth and tell us something about its atmosphere and tell us if it has the molecules that imply that the planet is perhaps habitable or even inhabited.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk with someone else here. Bloomington, Indiana is next. Line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I sure hope there are some more planets that accommodate life, but there are some real problems, just a few of these problems, to get a planet that will accommodate life. It has to be a rocky planet of the correct mass, has to be the correct distance from a very stable middle-aged star. It must rotate on its axis at just the correct speed, and its axis must tilt, but that axis tilt must be stable, can't be wobbling. Its natural atmosphere would have to be reduced. The natural atmosphere of a planet of the correct size to accommodate life, you got to reduce that atmosphere. Our natural atmosphere, the Earth's natural atmosphere, was reduced by a collision with a Mars-sized planet, a collision that was very precise, and that ultimately produced an atmosphere, a reduced pressure with the correct ratio of oxygen to an inert gas. It would be nitrogen. So that any planet accommodating life must have the correct ratio of oxygen. It must be in a system of planets that rotate in the same plane. No eccentrically rotating planets, or they will disturb our Earth's orbit. Can't do that. They have to all rotate in the same plane. If we had a Jupiter-sized planet close to our sun, as those planets have been found, but if we had one of those Jupiter-sized planets close to our sun, it would disturb our Earth's orbit. That would be fatal. But we must have a Jupiter-sized planet in a stable circular orbit far enough away not to disturb our orbit, but large enough to protect us from comets. And there are many, you know, plate tectonics, shielding from solar radiation. You can go on and on. What do you think?
Well, I think what you're talking about is basically the thesis of the book Rare Earths by Peter Ward and Don Brownlee from a few years back. And they've tried to make the case that intelligent life, at least, may not be as common as we might hope it would be. And they make a good point. There are a lot of peculiar things about our planetary system and our solar system that people have often inferred to be absolutely important for having intelligent life evolve. What I would make the case is that while we all would love to hear from ET nearby, I will make the case that most of the planets that we are going to be finding in the next 10 years will be habitable, and probably inhabited by not necessarily Neanderthals or human beings or something like them, but by at least rather primitive life forms of the sorts that populated the Earth for its first several billion years of existence. I don't think one needs to worry about some of these other factors like orbital stability of the type that we're talking about in order to have something which is perhaps analogous to the cryptanalytic bacteria that live in the rocks in Antarctica, which only live for basically 2 weeks out of the year when the sun happens to shine on their rock, and they get together and party and have fun, and then they go back to sleep again for another 50 weeks. Those are the sorts of things I think we're going to be able to find direct evidence for. Because even if nearby Earths have intelligent civilizations, unless they happen to be sending us radio waves or pulsed lasers in our directions, we're not going to know they're there. But we can measure, though, is whether or not their atmospheres have evidence for life in the form of oxygen, which is produced by photosynthesis, by basically cyanobacteria or blue-green algae, or perhaps methane produced by methanogenic bacteria. Again, rather simple singular cell creatures, archaea and bacteria, which they really can't hide themselves from us. If they are there in great abundance, like we expect they should be, then we're going to be able to see their signatures in the atmospheres of these planets. And so at the very least, we'll find if there is primitive life forms on these worlds. And I think that alone would be a tremendous step forward for humankind. That's the sort of thing we're looking for to trying to find on Mars right now, right? We're not really expecting to see interstates and canals. We're looking for little creatures that might live inside the rocks on Mars, and that's the same sort of search we're going to be launching for nearby Earths. And I would basically call it a horse race. I mean, I think there's a good chance we'll find life on Mars, but there's a good chance we might find life on a nearby planet even before that happens. So that's, to my mind, is the race. Are we going to find life on Mars first or life on a nearby Earth first? But as you say, it's not necessarily going to be very complex, intelligent life because of all the possible things that we may need to lead to our own existence. But I think at the very least we'll find some simple life forms.
Let me ask you one more question. Let's assume we find life on Mars, and it's DNA-based.
Yes.
What will that mean?
Well, what we're going to want to know is, are the handedness of their sugars and amino acids the same as the handedness of the sugars and amino acids that life uses on Earth? Of course, there's this unique preference for left-handed amino acids and right-handed sugars on that Earth life forms use. And so if we do find a DNA-based life form on Mars, which uses the opposite sense of amino acids and sugars, one can make the argument that they perhaps derived or evolved and originated independently. If they by chance happen to end up with the same handedness of sugars and amino acids that the life on Earth uses, then we'll have to wonder, are we actually Martians or are they actually terrestrial beings? Did somehow early collision with a meteoroid strike some stuff up off the Earth or Mars and send it to the other planet where it took root and began to grow? So that's going to be one of the big confusions, is if we do find life on Mars, we won't really be exactly sure as to whether it came from us or we came from it. Whereas I think we're pretty sure that if we do find evidence for single-cell creatures on some distant world, distant in the sense of 20, 30 light years, that there's lower chance, in fact, close to zero, I would say, that somehow that life could have come from us or we could have come from it. We do find life on another Earth-like planet. That's probably a very, very tight argument that is independently created compared to our life.
Well, this, and maybe we're getting into questions that would be better addressed by someone who is a biologist, I don't know, but I do wonder, of the findings, which would be more interesting if we'd found life elsewhere and it was essentially just like the life that we know, or that it was in some way fundamentally different?
Well, that is, of course, one of the great questions. We expect, actually, that probably life elsewhere will still be carbon-based. It'll be organic chemistry. People have thought about ways to try to reproduce complex chemistry that organic chemistry is without using carbon, using perhaps silicon as the basic element. But those attempts have not shown that anything better than carbon exists. And so my feeling is if you have a world with like the Earth with typical abundances of elements and silicon-based life was trying to do its thing and get going at the same time the carbon-based life is doing its thing and getting going. The carbon-based life would probably eat all the silicon-based life because carbon just seems to work better. It's a more effective way of putting together a life form. So whether or not it might have DNA, similar to our DNA, I think that basically comes back to whether or not organic chemistry is in all the ramifications of it is a unique way of putting things together. Its DNA is not necessarily going to have exactly the same amino acids involved in its work that our DNA does, but I suspect that something very similar to DNA might very well be common. But, you know, as you say, this is probably more of a question for a biologist to debate than for an astronomer like myself.
Well, and just to the extent that we can answer the question when we look out into the universe, we ask, well, what's the universe made of? Mm-hmm. As far as we can see, it seems to be made of the stuff we know: hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, iron. It's basically all the same elements. We haven't seen anything that was so strange, we had to say, well, we're not exactly sure what this is.
Oh, that's absolutely true. There's nothing that we know of out there that doesn't fall on the regular periodic mm-hmm. table of elements. The main variations are just the exact numbers of, you know, how many iron nuclei you have versus nickel versus nitrogen. Those sorts of variations are something astronomers love to study in great and gory detail. But you're talking about factors of 2 or 3 or 4, or maybe a factor of 10 from very different populations of stars. And within that uncertainty, one can easily imagine those still having organic chemistry like we have on Earth work quite nicely on most of these worlds.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 5, Eddie, just so let me introduce again very quickly, is Alan Boss. He's a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, and is one of the world's leading authorities on the formation of stars and planets. And he is the author of the recent book, The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. It's published by Basic Books and takes a look at the research that has been done in this country and elsewhere by scientists who are attempting to answer this question, are there other planets orbiting other stars? And the answer to that is yes. And then the question is, well, can we tell what these planets are like? And we can tell a lot of things about them. And then the question is, well, are there some that are like Earth where there might be some kind of life? And the answer to that question seems to be yes, and maybe getting more all the time. We have a number of callers here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Did you want to add something there before we went on to...
I was just going to make the point that I'm not sure if we touched on this yet, but we already have begun to find evidence of the tip of the iceberg of the terrestrial planet spectrum, you might say. Astronomers have found several dozen planets we call hot and warm super-Earths. These are planets with masses of maybe 5, 10, 15 times the mass of the Earth, and they tend to be orbiting a little bit closer to their stars than Earth is, so we call them hot and warm because they're not really quite probably cool enough to have liquid water on their surface. And these guys are the easiest ones to find. So if we can find a lot of these, and the estimates are that roughly one-third of sun-like stars have these hot and warm super-Earths, that alone implies that the more easier to make, more normal Earth-like planets, which we have not quite been able to detect yet, they should be even more abundant. So you're talking about a situation where, just based on what we know already, somewhere between one-third and all sun-like stars should have Earth-like planets, which is incredible. And that prediction is going to be tested by the Kepler mission. Mm.
And what number would that be? If you'll pardon me for saying so, it's astronomical, isn't it?
It is indeed. Basically, that means that essentially, to within a factor of 2 or something, essentially every sun-like star should have one Earth-like planet. So for the 100 billion sun-like stars in our galaxy, you're talking about something close to 100 billion Earths in our galaxy alone.
So then if you go back to the point the earlier caller made about the fact that there are a number of things that have to be in place, at least we think that have to be in place for there to be life, you would think that the odds are among all of those Earth-like planets, we should be able to find a few. That have all the right characteristics.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there were a lot of restrictions that were placed by the previous caller. That's, as I said, is one of the theses of the book Rare Earths. But I would argue that that is really all leading up to intelligent life, which has arisen exactly the way that we have as human beings on our Earth. But I have the feeling that life is a pretty tenacious phenomena, and it can actually survive through a much more turbulent way of living than we have on our rather feeble way of getting by on Earth. And I suspect that even situations where planets are in eccentric orbits a bit, as long as they're roughly stable, but their distances from the sun as are increasing much more than the Earth does, that there will be things like the cryptanalytic bacteria that manage to survive. They may only live for a few months out of the year, and then they go back to sleep again for a while and wait for things to warm up, and they do their thing again. But even on such worlds, which we would no way think that we would want to live on, there may be some creatures that are quite happy there. That's all they know, and that's what they love.
All right. Let's talk with some other callers, and then we'll go next to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was told somewhere along the way, you might confirm if this is true or not, that the reason that Mars is a dead planet is because it is no longer geologically active, and because it's no longer geologically active, it does not have anything the equivalent of our Van Allen radiation belt, the magnetosphere, to protect it from whatever it is that I forgot now that the Van Allen radiation belt protects us from. I was thinking, would one way that and is this possible that one could, once say you have a collection of possible Earth-like planets, are there ways to sense whether or not one heavenly body is geologically active and has a radiation belt and so forth, and therefore is perhaps somewhat of a better candidate for life to exist? And also, is it possible, or would there be some advantage, do you think, to build a radio telescope in space away from terrestrial noise and, of course, out of the atmosphere and things like that, to just passively listen? Isn't it possible with radio telemetry to measure the temperature of objects in space that that are otherwise, you know, aren't luminous? And with that methodology, you get also, this is looking more like the Goldilocks planet. You know, it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's got all these features that are that we think are necessary for life, and so on and so forth, and even be able to perhaps, you know, pick up the inadvertently pick up the equivalent of some other civilization's earliest radio transmissions. You know, its first attempts at Fibber-McGee and Molly or their equivalent, and we'd be able to kibitz on those and say, yep, there's intelligent life there. They're up to something. So comment on that, please.
Yeah, well, you've touched on an awful lot of topics here. I'm sure I cannot pick up the thread for all of them. But in the case of Mars, one of the main problems with having abundant life forms on the surface of Mars is not necessarily so much radiation belts and shielding from the solar wind and from incoming cosmic rays, but it's just the fact that the Mars atmosphere is so thin. It's roughly only 1% of the Earth's atmosphere, and that means that the ultraviolet light from the sun comes in and is not stopped by something like terrestrial ozone, and so you really have a very harsh environment on the surface of Mars in terms of UV light, because UV light can be quite destructive for living beings. So that's why the feeling is that on Mars, at least, the best place to look for life is underground. We know, of course, on the Earth that there are probably more creatures living underground than on the surface of the Earth. It's hard for many folks to believe that, but folks who do drilling for oil realize that there's an awful lot of gunk down there in the drilling well that comes up where things are actually living underground. And so that's probably the best analog for Mars life, is finding something like cryptanalytic bacteria from the Antarctic dry valleys or something which lives in the rocks and gets therefore sheltered from the ultraviolet light. In terms of looking for planets by electromagnetic radiation, there actually are serious proposals to try to find at least Jupiter-like planets using radio telescopes, because Jupiter, for example, gives off a lot of so-called decametric radiation from its interactions with Io and the Io plasma torus and so on. In fact, Bernie Burke, who was a Carnegie staff member in the mid-1950s, managed to detect Jupiter by accident. He had built a radio telescope in a playing field near Potomac, Maryland, and they were studying X-ray sources on the sky, and by chance they noticed something which turned out to be correlated with Jupiter. So they actually just stumbled upon Jupiter by measuring its decametric radiation. So there actually are serious proposals to do that right now with radio telescopes, but they've yet to be able to find a planet that way. In terms of trying to measure an extrasolar Earth with its magnetic field, I don't think we have much hope of being able to do that. The Earth just doesn't give off as strong radiation as Jupiter does from its magnetic fields. So instead, what we'll do is to try to understand the atmospheres of those planets and their temperatures by making measurements of their spectra at either optical or infrared wavelengths, mid-infrared wavelengths. Those two wavelengths, if you study the planets and understand which molecules appear in the spectrum and understand what the conditions are that are required to have those molecules be seen, that can tell you something about how hot the planet's atmosphere is. So that'll be the way that we understand what is happening in the atmosphere. And, of course, we would love to be able to pick up some radio emissions of their version of Fibber-McGee and Molly show. I mean, that's what the whole SETI folks, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence folks, are planning on doing. That really is the ultimate way of trying to find out if there really is intelligent life elsewhere in our galaxy. Since we've argued before, it's rather hard for us to travel there or for them to travel here. It's just not going to happen given the speed of light. The best way for us to find out about them and for them to find out about us is to send radio programs back and forth, or television programs, whatever you want to call it, by sending light waves and radio waves back and forth. That's the way the wave of the future.
Well, and that listening effort has been going on now, I think, for some time, hasn't it?
Yes, from back in the 60s, I believe, Frank Drake started doing things using the radio telescopes for quite some time now. And they actually have built a rather large array called the Allen Telescope Array in Northern California near Hat Creek. Using money from Microsoft's Paul Allen, I think they've got something like on the order of 40 or 50 radio telescopes up and running in a sort of like interferometer with very small telescopes all linked together into one giant telescope. they'd like to build a lot more. I think they want to have plans to bring up to something like 360 telescopes altogether. They're only a fraction of the way there. So if you'd like to help out with SETI and have a little telescope named after you, send them a check, and they'll be happy to buy a telescope for you and put your name on it and get you online.
All right. Let's go to another caller here. West Chicago, our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Now, with the times the way they are right now, the economic breakdown, I'm a very avid science person with NASA, and they do have a number of projects that are on the books. And don't you think we ought to back off of some of this, at least for the next couple of years? It seems to me that we've got a lot of things going on, and I think we need to start consolidating, maybe, like you said just now, you know, private contributions would work just fine. I think we need to start looking at how we can, as citizens, either, you know, give money to science or you know, not have the government take, I guess what I'm saying is the government, less of the government money and more. Like Bert Rutan, I've read a lot about Bert Rutan and this thing with Richard Branson. I think that's a good way to go. There's a lot of science projects being done out there by private enterprises. I was just curious, is there any one particular one out there that could maybe, you know, save us some money in the long run? It just seems like we got too much stuff going on at one time. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, it would be wonderful if we could find private philanthropists to fund some of these efforts. And there are several ground-based planet search efforts or astronomical efforts underway, which would be happy to accept a couple $100 million from whoever's willing to give them one. One of the big efforts for ground-based telescopes are to go beyond the sort of the 8-10 meter class telescopes, which are the largest telescopes now, and to start building the next generation of really large telescopes. So there's a Carnegie Institution venture called the Giant Magellan Telescope, where they hope to build a telescope that's about 24 meters in diameter, which is considerably larger than anything exists now. And that project costs maybe $700 million, and right now Carnegie and its partners are all trying to find a way to raise $700 million. That seems like an awful lot of money, but Carnegie and other places have been able to build telescopes using private money, like the Keck telescopes in Hawaii, built by Caltech and University of California. That's not quite that expensive, but it's in the order of hundreds of millions of dollars. We'd love to see that happen, but for space-based telescopes, they tend to be even a bit more expensive than that. Even the sort of the SIM light version that JPL would like to build would probably cost at least $700 million, if not a bit more. The terrestrial planet finders, which are the ones which give us the ability to actually study the spectra of nearby stars and look for molecules that imply that it's inhabitable and even inhabited, those are probably more in the order of several billion dollars. Maybe a year ago when the economy was flying high, I would have thought that there were, you know, enough Bill Gates out there and Warren Buffetts that they could give a couple $1 billion to build a space telescope. But those philanthropists tend to be often more interested in trying to help out humanity by solving AIDS and getting rid of mosquitoes and so on than worrying about trying to find a new world nearby. So I'd love to see it happen, but I think in the short run, we really are, or even the long run, we really are going to be reliant on governments, NASA, and particularly the European Space Agency. We'd love to actually see NASA collaborate with the European Space Agency to build one of these terrestrial planet finder telescopes. The scientists have been working together for many years to come up with ideas for the designs, and they have some designs they both agree would be optimal. They'd love to do that. Unfortunately, NASA just doesn't have the money for it in its budget right now. They were planning to do that. President Bush's vision for space exploration said NASA should do it, but there was no money around. So I feel that even though we're in incredibly tight economic times right now, the things that NASA's doing or could be doing here in terms of finding other Earths, they really, you know, give us a reason for being happy and doing what we're doing. I'd much rather hear about what Kepler's about to find than another Bernie Madoff story, which, you know, gets pretty depressing after a while. And I don't think we can really, we should not even consider cutting back to zero on our science efforts, even though we're in tough economic times. It's sort of like, you know, saying Queen Isabel and King Ferdinand, maybe they can't bother to send Columbus to the New World this year because there are a few folks in Toledo who are still kind of hungry. If we wait until we solve all of our problems on Earth, we'll never do anything because there are always going to be problems. So we have to do things in parallel. We have to strike that right balance between
taking care of our own human beings here, but also giving them something to dream about, a reason to live, as it were, to think about how wonderful the universe is, and maybe we can find some nearby Earth. At least that's my own personal opinion.
Alan Boss is our guest. He is a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. He is one of the world's leading authorities on the formation of stars and planets and is the author of the book The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. It's published by Basic Books. And you, at the very introduction of the book, in fact, you write that there is a you write there is a new space race underway, and it's not one between the U.S. and Russia or between the U.S. and China. It's between the United States and Europe, and it is a race to find Earth-like planets. It's the scientific enterprise that we've been talking about here, and I am assuming that that the Europeans that are apparently ahead of us right at the moment, that this is research that's funded by European governments.
Exactly so. The French launched a satellite called COROT, standing for Convection Rotation and Planetary Transits, back a little over 2 years ago, back in December of 2006. And so they're actually trying to beat Kepler to the punch. They're trying to find Earth-like planets using their own transit photometry space telescope. They're looking for planets by looking for transits the same way that Kepler, which was just launched a month ago, will do. And I sort of, in a tongue-in-cheek way, implied this was a major space race. But in reality, of course, scientists, we all know each other. We're all happy for either one's success. It's more like the Olympics. We all want to win the gold medal, but we'll be happy with the silver or the bronze. We want to know how many Earths are out there. And if the Europeans find them first, we will applaud them. If we find them first, I hope they would applaud us. And maybe we'll eventually have missions where we fly together, like we often have, like Hubble and James Webb Space Telescope. They're joint U.S.-European missions. On something as ambitious as the terrestrial planet finders, I would hope that we would find a way to work with the Europeans there, too, and find these things jointly. Because these are discoveries that are made one time, right? In the hundreds of thousands of years of leading up to human beings, we're now in the era where we're finding evidence for the first time, real hard proof of life elsewhere, planets elsewhere. And this is something which belongs not to the U.S. or the Europeans. It belongs to all of humanity. So this is something we should be doing together.
To go back just a step or two, we talked about the fact that the distances here are such that we're not going to be able to visit, we're not even going to be able to send a probe. But so what we have to do is we're using telescopes, space-based telescopes, and we're going to be, the way that we're going to investigate the possibility of life on these Earth-like planets is by looking. But apparently there is a great deal that you can actually know by making that kind of observation. You can figure out how big these planets are, and indeed you can get a pretty good idea about what it is that they're made of.
Yes, we basically, if you have a transit occur, for example, you can get the size of the planet because by seeing how much the star's light is dimmed, if you know the size of the star, you can estimate the size of the planet, so you can get a density. If you have a mass from looking at how much the star wobbles around its center of mass, you can get a mass of the planet that's causing that wobble to occur. So you get a density and a mass, that's a lot, and then if you can actually take an observation of its atmosphere of the planet by using one of these terrestrial planet finders, we'll learn something about what are the composition of its atmosphere is. We'll have carbon dioxide, which is a hallmark of a terrestrial planet. Venus, Earth, and Mars all show strong carbon dioxide features in their spectra. Look for water. Really, only Earth shows a strong water feature, showing that it's a habitable planet. Then you go on to look for things like ozone and oxygen, which are produced by photosynthesis by bacteria, cyanobacteria, and even perhaps methane, which comes from methanogenic bacteria, bacteria that live in regions without much water, like in swamps and things like cow guts, for example. If you can find those basic four molecules, those biomarkers, that will tell us an awful lot about whether or not that world really is inhabited.
Now, you could find those things. Those things could be there, and there still could not be any living things.
It depends on the levels, I think. For example, in Mars right now, there's a very small amount of methane in Mars' atmosphere. It's just been really proven to really exist just in the last couple of months by Michael Moom and his colleagues at NASA Goddard. And that's one of the arguments now going on for Mars, is we now know that Mars does have at least a small amount of methane. And the question is that coming from the just decay of rocks, regular chemical processing of rocks, or is actually coming from the decay of some organic material that's buried down deep inside the planet, which is coming out in gullies and edges of cliffs and stuff, and somehow that's releasing the Mars methane. So in Mars, the mantra should be not just look for the water, but look for the methane. And that's what Mars scientists are focusing on now. If we find a nearby Earth-like planet which has a strong methane signal, I mean, we could not detect Martian level of methane on any nearby world. We just would not have enough photons to measure that. But if we see a really strong booming methane signal like the one that Earth has, and a strong booming oxygen signal like Earth does, and water and carbon dioxide. I think the most common interpretation of that will be that there is some life there. There may be a few folks who will want to argue about it. Scientists love to argue about things and take both sides of every question. But I think if you really see a strong signal, that's going to be pretty persuasive evidence that there is something alive on that planet. Maybe methanogenic bacteria and blue-green algae, or maybe it's dairy cows munching grass. But it's going to be somewhere in between. One of those two is going to have to be creating those signals.
And as you look out there, scientists have looked for planets orbiting other stars, you have found planets that are like the ones that we have in our solar system. So you found ones that are kind of like Jupiter. You found ones that are like Neptune and Uranus. So is the idea that the kinds of planets that we know that are actually in our solar system, roughly speaking, positioned where they are, if you look at other places where you find other planets orbiting stars, would you expect to find solar systems, collections of different kinds of planets, basically lined up the way that ours are? Is that something that you would expect to find other places?
We've actually already found them already. Yeah. There are a number of systems where these hot and warm super-Earths are seen to orbit, and in most cases they are accompanied by longer-period outer gas giant planets, Jupiters and Saturns. So it's a situation which looks very much like our own solar system, inner terrestrial planets, outer gas giants, and that is a very strong, perhaps the strongest argument that we actually have found terrestrial or analogs of terrestrial planets, because we believe there are good reasons why terrestrial planets would form inside of the gas giants, and that same situation seems to have occurred among these other solar systems. So we really, as you say, we have examples of all three basic types of planets in our solar systems: gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn, ice giants like Uranus and Neptune, and we're seeing these hot and warm super-Earths, which we think are the terrestrial analogs of our Earth, Mars, and Venus. So we're already 99% of the way there. We just have to go out and count some Earths, which is what Kepler's going to do for us, and tell us how many Earths there are.
Mm. Just maybe one last question, and this is, again, pulling into a little closer, and this is perhaps a different kind of research that we're talking about. But can you say something about what sort of effort there might be to try to develop a kind of probe that would, talked earlier about the fact that we are looking for signs of life on Mars, and that there are some people who make the argument that perhaps at least one of the moons of Jupiter would be a good place to look. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we're going to get to the point where we're actually going to do that?
Oh, absolutely. It's just a question of time. You know, trying to understand Europa, the Jovian moon, which is a really intriguing place, seems to have an ice-covered ocean of some sort. We don't know how thick the ice is, but it's been hypothesized there might be dolphins swimming in that ocean down below there, or the cold-blooded dolphins, I'm sure, but dolphins nevertheless, somewhat jokingly, of course. There is an imperative. Eventually, we will explore Europa. It may take us a little while to get there. Maybe it's 30 years in the future, but our children and grandchildren, they're going to be knowing what's on Europa. There are only a limited number of places in our solar system that are really nice-looking places for life: Mars, Europa, Titan. And given time, we will go there. We'll check them out.
Well, there, I think we're going to have to leave it. If people would like to read more on the subject, the book to look for is the one we mentioned a couple times here. It's The Crowded Universe. The subtitle is The Search for Living Planets by our guest, Dr. Alan Boss. He's a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. And Dr. Boss, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's a pleasure.
Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. A little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, they'll be going to the archives for a conversation with David Gran, author of The Lost City of Z. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour. It looks back to an expedition that took place in the 20s, where Colonel Percy Harrison Fawcett and his son disappeared in the Mato Grosso region of Brazil, searching for a mysterious city initially discovered in the mid-1700s. You can hear that conversation in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. We'll also be going to the archives in our second hour for a show looking at the biggest newspaper hoax ever in history. It took place here in the United States, in New York City, back in the 1830s. We'll have more on that in the second hour of Focus 580. First, though, we'll break for news and update on the markets, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers, because everything they do starts with you.
Morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. We're seeing some bear spreading going on or unwinding of bull spreads, one or the other, in the soybean pit. We'll go ahead and get to the particulars right away. And we'll begin in the soybeans with May now trading at 9.93 and three quarters, down 1 3/4. July, 9.93 and a half, down 1 3/4. August, 9.73 and a quarter, down 3.5. September, 9.38 and a half, down 7 3/4. November, 9.08 and a quarter, down 15. And January 2010 at 9.20 and a quarter, down 11 3/4. May soybean meal, 307.60 is up 160. July, 304.40 is up 140. May soybean oil, 34.86, down 46. July, 35.10, down 48. May corn, 404 and a quarter, down a quarter. July, 414 and a quarter, now 414 even, down 3/4. December, 435, down a half. March of 2000.